Hello and welcome back to Off the Deaton Path. My name is Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society, and we welcome you to this podcast for the week of Christmas, December 24th, 2018. This week, in honor of the Christmas season, we are presenting a part of a chapter from one of my favorite stories of Charles Dickens. Dickens, of course, wrote many stories about Christmas, most famously A Christmas Carol, published in 1843. But I'm going to read the chapter about Christmas from the Pickwick Papers, or as it's officially titled, the Posthumous Papers of the Pickwick Club. Dickens first published the Pickwick Papers in a serial version, the first part of which appeared in February 1836, when Dickens was an astonishingly young 24 years old. Through 20 monthly installments, through 1836 and 1837, readers fell in love with the exploits of Mr. Samuel Pickwick and his companions, Tracy Tubman, Nathaniel Winkle, and Augustus Snodgrass, and of course, Mr. Pickwick's valet, Sam Weller. Throughout the book, they travel around London and more remote locations in England and meet a variety of interesting characters, most notably Alfred Jingle, Mr. Wardle of Dingleydale Manor Farm, Joe the Fat Boy, Job Trotter, Dodson and Fogg, and a host of others. If you've never read it, I really hope that you'll do yourself a favor and make it one of the books you read in 2019. I'm reading today from Chapter 28, the short title of which is called A Good-Humored Christmas Chapter, but is popularly known as Christmas at Dingleydale. I hope you enjoy it. As brisk as bees, if not altogether as light as fairies, did the four Pickwickians assemble on the morning of the 22nd day of December, in the year of grace in which these, their faithfully recorded adventures, were undertaken and accomplished. Christmas was close at hand in all his bluff and hearty honesty. It was the season of hospitality, merriment, and open-heartedness. The old year was preparing, like an ancient philosopher, to call his friends around him, and amidst the sound of feasting and revelry, to pass gently and calmly away. Gay and merry was the time, and right gay and merry were at least four of the numerous hearts that were gladdened by its coming. And numerous indeed are the hearts to which Christmas brings a brief season of happiness and enjoyment. How many families, whose members have been dispersed and scattered far and wide in the restless struggles of life, are then reunited and meet once again in that happy state of companionship and mutual goodwill, which is a source of such pure and unalloyed delight, and one so incompatible with the cares and sorrows of the world. How many old recollections and how many dormant sympathies does Christmas awaken? We write these words now, many miles distant from the spot at which, year after year, we met on that day, a merry and joyous circle. Many of the hearts that throbbed so gaily then have ceased to beat. Many of the looks that shone so brightly then have ceased to glow. The hands we grasped have grown cold. The eyes we sought have hid their luster in the grave. And yet the old house, the room, the merry voices and smiling faces, the jest, the laugh, the most minute and trivial circumstance connected with those happy meetings crowd upon our mind at each recurrence of the season, as if the last assemblage had been but yesterday. Happy, happy Christmas, that can win us back to the delusions of our childish days, that can recall to the old man the pleasures of his youth, and transport the sailor and the traveler thousands of miles away, back to his own fireside and his quiet home. But we are so taken up and occupied with the good qualities of Christmas, who, by the way, is quite a country gentleman of the old school, that we are keeping Mr. Pickwick and his friends waiting in the cold, on the outside of the Muggleton coach, which they have just attained, well wrapped up in greatcoats, shawls, and comforters. The portmanteaus and carpet bags have been stowed away, and Mr. Weller and the guard are endeavoring to insinuate into the foreboot a huge codfish several sizes too large for it, which is snugly packed up in a long brown basket with a layer of straw over the top, which has been left to the last in order that he may repose in safety on the half-dozen barrels of real native oysters, all the property of Mr. Pickwick, which have been arranged in regular order at the bottom of the receptacle. The interest displayed in Mr. Pickwick's countenance is most intense, as Mr. Weller and the guard try to squeeze the codfish into the boot, first head first, and then tail first, and then top upwards, and then bottom upwards, and then sideways, and then long ways, all of which artifices the implacable codfish sturdily resist, until the guard accidentally hits him in the very middle of the basket, whereupon he suddenly disappears into the boot, and with him the head and shoulders of the guard himself, who, not calculating upon so sudden a cessation of the passive resistance of the codfish, experiences a very unexpected shock, to the unsmotherable delight of all the porters and bystanders. Upon this, Mr. Pickwick smiles with great good humor, and drawing a shilling from his waistcoat pocket, begs the guard, as he picks himself out of the boot, to drink his health in a glass of hot brandy and water, at which the guard smiles too, and Messrs. Snodgrass, Winkle, and Tupman all smile in company. The guard and Mr. Weller disappear for 5 minutes, most probably to get the hot brandy and water, for they smell very strongly of it. When they return, the coachman mounts to the box, Mr. Weller jumps up behind, the Pickwickians pull their coats round their legs and their shawls over their noses, the helpers pull the horse cloths off, the coachman shouts out a cheery, "All right!" and away they go. And now the bugle plays a lively air as the coach rattles through the ill-paved streets of a country town, and the coachman, undoing the buckle which keeps his ribbons together, prepares to throw them off the moment he stops. Mr. Pickwick emerges from his coat collar and looks about him with great curiosity, perceiving which, the coachman informs Mr. Pickwick of the name of the town and tells him it was market day yesterday, both which pieces of information Mr. Pickwick retails to his fellow passengers. Whereupon they emerge from their coat collars too and look about them also. Mr. Winkle, who sits at the extreme edge, with one leg dangling in the air, is nearly precipitated into the street as the coach twists round the sharp corner by the cheesemonger's shop and turns into the marketplace. And before Mr. Snodgrass, who sits next to him, has recovered from his alarm, they pull up at the inn yard, where the fresh horses with cloths on are already waiting. The coachman throws down the reins and gets down himself, and the other outside passengers drop down also, except those who have no great confidence in their ability to get up again, and they remain where they are, and stamp their feet against the coach to warm them, looking with longing eyes and red noses at the bright fire in the inn bar, and the sprigs of holly with red berries which ornament the window. But the guard has delivered at the corn dealer's shop the brown paper packet he took out of the little pouch which hangs over his shoulder by a leather strap, and has seen the horses carefully put to, and has thrown on the pavement the saddle which was brought from London on the coach roof, and has assisted in the conference between the coachman and the hostler about the gray mare that hurt her off foreleg last Tuesday, and he and Mr. Weller are all right behind, and the coachman is all right in front, and the old gentleman inside, who has kept the window down full 2 inches all this time, has pulled it up again, and the cloths are off, and they are all ready for starting, except the two stout gentlemen, whom the coachman inquires after with some impatience. Hereupon the coachman and the guard, and Sam Weller, and Mr. Winkle and Mr. Snodgrass, and all the hostlers, and every one of the idlers, who are more in number than all the others put together, shout for the missing gentleman as loud as they can bawl. A distant response is heard from the yard, and Mr. Pickwick and Mr. Tupman come running down it quite out of breath, for they have been having a glass of ale apiece, and Mr. Pickwick's fingers are so cold that he has been 5 full minutes before he could find the sixpence to pay for it. The coachman shouts an admonitory, "Now then, gentlemen!" The guard re-echoes it. The old gentleman inside thinks it a very extraordinary thing that people will get down when they know there isn't time for it. Mr. Pickwick struggles up one side, Mr. Tupman on the other. Mr. Winkle cries, "All right!" And off they start. Shawls are pulled up. Coat collars are readjusted. The pavement ceases, the houses disappear, and they are once again dashing along the open road with the fresh, clear air blowing in their faces and gladdening their very hearts within them. Such was the progress of Mr. Pickwick and his friends by the Muggleton Telegraph on their way to Dingley Dell, and at 3 o'clock that afternoon they all stood, high and dry, safe and sound, hale and hearty, upon the steps of the Blue Lion, having taken on the road quite enough of ale and brandy to enable them to bid defiance to the frost that was binding up the earth in its iron fetters and weaving its beautiful network upon the trees and hedges. Mr. Pickwick was busily engaged in counting the barrels of oysters and superintending the disinterment of the codfish when he felt himself gently pulled by the skirts of the coat, and looking round, he discovered that the individual who resorted to this mode of catching his attention was no other than Mr. Wardle's favorite page, better known to the readers of this unvarnished history by the distinguishing appellation of the Fat Boy. "Aha!" said Mr. Pickwick. "Aha!" said the Fat Boy. And as he said it, he glanced from the codfish to the oyster barrels and chuckled joyously. He was fatter than ever. "Well, you look rosy enough, my young friend," said Mr. Pickwick. "I've been asleep, right in front of the taproom fire," replied the Fat Boy, who had heated himself to the color of a new chimney pot in the course of an hour's nap. "Master sent me over with the chay cart to carry your luggage up to the house. He'd have sent some saddle horses, but he thought you'd rather walk, being a cold day." "Yes, yes," said Mr. Pickwick hastily, for he remembered how they had traveled over nearly the same ground on a previous occasion. "Yes, we would rather walk. Here, Sam."
"Sir," said Mr. Weller.
"Help Mr. Wardle's servant to put the packages into the cart, and then ride on with him. We will walk forward at once." Mr. Pickwick and his friends, having walked their blood into active circulation, proceeded cheerfully on. The paths were hard, the grass was crisp and frosty, the air had a fine, dry, bracing coldness, and the rapid approach of the gray twilight, slate-colored is a better term in frosty weather, made them look forward with pleasant anticipation to the comforts which awaited them at their hospitable entertainers. It was the sort of afternoon that might induce a couple of elderly gentlemen, in a lonely field, to take off their greatcoats and play at leapfrog in pure lightness of heart and gaiety. And we firmly believe that had Mr. Tupman at that moment proffered a back, Mr. Pickwick would have accepted his offer with the utmost avidity. However, Mr. Tupman did not volunteer any such personal accommodation, and the friends walked on, conversing merrily. As they turned into a lane which they had to cross, the sound of many voices burst upon their ears, and before they even had time to form a guess as to whom they belonged, they walked into the very center of the party who were expecting their arrival, a fact which was first notified to the Pickwickians by the loud "Hurrah!" which burst from old Wardle's lips when they appeared in sight. First, there was Wardle himself, looking, if that were possible, more jolly than ever. Then there were Bella and her faithful Trundle, and lastly, there were Emily and some 8 or 10 young ladies who had all come down to the wedding which was to take place next day, and were in as happy and important a state as young ladies usually are on such momentous occasions. And they were, one and all, startling the fields and lanes far and wide with their frolic and laughter. But if they were social and happy outside the house, what was the warmth and cordiality of their reception when they reached the farm? The very servants grinned with pleasure at the sight of Mr. Pickwick, and Emma bestowed a half-demure, half-impudent, and all-pretty look of recognition on Mr. Tupman, which was enough to make the statue of Bonaparte in the passage unfold his arms and clasp her within them. The old lady was seated in customary state in the front parlor, but she was rather cross, and by consequence most particularly deaf. She never went out herself, and like a great many older ladies of the same stamp, she was apt to consider it an act of domestic treason if anybody else took the liberty of doing what she couldn't. So, bless her old soul, she sat as upright as she could in her great chair and looked as fierce as might be, and that was benevolent after all. "Mother," said Wardle, "Mr. Pickwick, you recollect him." "Never mind," replied the old lady with great dignity. "Don't trouble Mr. Pickwick about an old creature like me. Nobody cares about me now, and it's very natural they shouldn't." Here the old lady tossed her head and smoothed down her lavender-colored silk dress with trembling hands. "Come, come, ma'am," said Mr. Pickwick. "I can't let you cut an old friend in this way. I have come down expressly to have a long talk and another rubber with you, and we'll show these boys and girls how to dance a minuet before they're 8 and 40 hours older." The old lady was rapidly giving way, but she did not like to do it all at once. So she only said, "Ah, I can't hear him." "Nonsense, mother," said Wardle. "Come, come, don't be cross, there's a good soul. Recollect Bella. Come, you must keep her spirits up, poor girl." The good old lady heard this, for her lip quivered as her son said it. But age has its little infirmities of temper, and she was not quite brought round yet. So
She smoothed down the lavender-colored dress again, and turning to Mr. Pickwick said, "Ah, Mr. Pickwick, young people was very different when I was a girl."
"No doubt of that, ma'am," said Mr. Pickwick, "and that's the reason why I would make much of the few that have any traces of the old stock."
And saying this, Mr. Pickwick gently pulled Bella towards him, and bestowing a kiss upon her forehead, bade her sit down on a little stool at her grandmother's feet. Whether the expression of her countenance, as it was raised toward the old lady's face, called up a thought of old times, or whether the old lady was touched by Mr. Pickwick's affectionate good nature, or whatever was the cause, she was fairly melted. So she threw herself on her granddaughter's neck, and all the little ill humor evaporated in a gush of silent tears. A happy party they were that night. Sedate and solemn were the score of rubbers in which Mr. Pickwick and the old lady played together, and uproarious was the mirth of the round table. Long after the ladies had retired did the hot elder wine, well qualified with brandy and spice, go round and round and round again, and sound was the sleep, and pleasant were the dreams that followed. The best sitting room at Manor Farm was a good, long, dark-paneled room with a high chimney-piece, and a capacious chimney, up which you could have driven one of the new patent cabs, wheels and all. At the upper end of the room, seated in a shady bower of holly and evergreens, were the two best fiddlers and the only harp in all Muggleton. In all sorts of recesses, and on all kinds of brackets, stood massive old silver candlesticks with four branches each. The carpet was up, the candles burnt bright, the fire blazed and crackled on the hearth, and merry voices and light-hearted laughter rang through the room. If any of the old English yeomen had turned into fairies when they died, it was just the place in which they would have held their revels. They all wended their way to the large kitchen, in which the family were by this time assembled, according to annual custom on Christmas Eve, observed by old Wardle's forefathers from time immemorial. From the center of the ceiling of this kitchen, old Wardle had just suspended with his own hands a huge branch of mistletoe, and the same branch of mistletoe instantaneously gave rise to a scene of general and most delightful struggling and confusion, in the midst of which Mr. Pickwick, with a gallantry which would have done honor to a descendant of Lady Tollenglower herself, took the old lady by the hand, led her beneath the mystic branch, and saluted her in all courtesy and decorum. The old lady submitted to this piece of practical politeness with all the dignity which befitted so important and serious a solemnity, but the younger ladies, not being so thoroughly imbued with the superstitious veneration of the custom, or imagining that the value of a salute is very much enhanced if it cost a little trouble to obtain it, screamed and struggled and ran into corners, and threatened and remonstrated and did everything but leave the room, until some of the less adventurous gentlemen were on the point of desisting, when they all at once found it useless to resist any longer and submitted to be kissed with a good grace. Mr. Winkle kissed the young lady with the black eyes, and Mr. Snodgrass kissed Emily, and Mr. Weller, not being particular about the form of being under the mistletoe, kissed Emma and the other female servants, just as he caught them. As to the poor relations, they kissed everybody, not even excepting the plainer portion of the young lady visitors, who in their excessive confusion ran right under the mistletoe, directly it was hung up without knowing it. Wardle stood with his back to the fire, surveying the whole scene with the utmost satisfaction, and the fat boy took the opportunity of appropriating to his own use and summarily devouring a particularly fine mince pie that had been carefully put by for somebody else. Now the screaming had subsided, and faces were in a glow and curls in a tangle, and Mr. Pickwick, after kissing the old lady as before mentioned, was standing under the mistletoe, looking with a very pleased countenance on all that was passing round him, when the young lady with the black eyes, after a little whispering with the other young ladies, made a sudden dart forward, and putting her arm round Mr. Pickwick's neck, saluted him affectionately on the left cheek. And before Mr. Pickwick distinctly knew what was the matter, he was surrounded by the whole body, and kissed by every one of them. It was a pleasant thing to see Mr. Pickwick in the center of the group, now pulled this way and then that, and first kissed on the chin, and then on the nose, and then on the spectacles, and to hear the peals of laughter which were raised on every side. But it was a still more pleasant thing to see Mr. Pickwick, blinded shortly afterwards with a silk handkerchief, falling up against the wall and scrambling into corners, and going through all the mysteries of Blind Man's Bluff, with the utmost relish for the game, until at last he caught one of the poor relations, and then had to evade the blind man himself, which he did, with a nimbleness and agility that elicited the admiration and applause of all beholders. The poor relations caught just the people whom they thought would like it, and when the game flagged, got caught themselves. When they were all tired of Blind Man's Bluff, there was a great game at Snapdragon, and when fingers enough were burned with that, and all the raisins gone, they sat down by the huge fire of blazing logs to a substantial supper, and a mighty bowl of wassail, something smaller than an ordinary wash-house copper, in which the hot apples were hissing and bubbling with a rich look and a jolly sound that were perfectly irresistible. "This," said Mr. Pickwick, looking round him, "this is, indeed, comfort." "Our invariable custom," replied Mr. Wardle. "Everybody sits down with us on Christmas Eve, as you see them now, servants and all, and here we wait till the clock strikes 12 to usher Christmas in, and while away the time with forfeits and old stories. Trundle, my boy, rake up the fire." Up flew the bright sparks in myriads as the logs were stirred, and the deep red blaze sent forth a rich glow that penetrated into the farthest corner of the room and cast its cheerful tint on every face. "Come," said Wardle, "a song, a Christmas song. I'll give you one in default of a better." "Bravo," said Mr. Pickwick. "Fill up," cried Wardle. "It will be 2 hours good before you see the bottom of the bowl through the deep rich color of the wassail. Fill up all round. And now for the song." This song was tumultuously applauded, for friends and dependents make a capital audience, and the poor relations especially were in perfect ecstasies of rapture. Again was the fire replenished, and again went the wassail round. "How it snows," said one of the men in a low tone.
"Snows, does it?" said Wardle.
"Rough, cold night, sir," replied the man, "and there's a wind got up that drifts it across the fields in a thick white cloud."
"What does Jim say?" inquired the old lady. "There ain't anything the matter, is there?"
"No, no, mother," replied Wardle. "He says there's a snowdrift and a wind that's piercing cold. I should know that by the way it rumbles in the chimney."
"Ah," said the old lady, "there was just such a wind and just such a fall of snow a good many years back, I recollect. Just 5 years before your poor father died. It was a Christmas Eve, too, and I remember that on that very night he told us the story about the goblins that carried away old Gabriel Grubb."
"The story about what?" said Mr. Pickwick.
"Oh, nothing, nothing," replied Wardle. "About an old sexton that the good people down here supposed to have been carried away by goblins."
"Suppose?" ejaculated the old lady. "Are there anybody hardly enough to disbelieve it? Suppose? Haven't you heard ever since you were a child that he was carried away by the goblins, and don't you know he was?"
"Very well, mother, he was, if you like," said Wardle, laughing. "He was carried away by goblins, Pickwick, and there's an end of the matter."
"No, no," said Mr. Pickwick, "not an end of it, I assure you, for I must hear now, and why, and all about it."
Wardle smiled, as every head was bent forward to hear, and filling out the wassail with no stinted hand, nodded a health to Mr. Pickwick, and began as follows. But bless our editorial heart, what a long chapter we have been betrayed into. We had quite forgotten all such petty restrictions as chapters, we solemnly declare. So here goes to give the goblin a fair start in a new one. A clear stage and no favor for the goblins, ladies and gentlemen, if you please.
And that concludes our special presentation of Christmas at Dingley Dell from the Pickwick Papers by Charles Dickens. The hardest working engineer in show business, now the czar of our Tallahassee office, as well as the captain of the GHS under 40 soccer team, is our very own Brendan Cannonball Krellen. Our mailman this week and every week is Crimson Tide fan extraordinaire, one Gary F. Taylor, born and raised, that's right, who is away this week attending the Gilroy Garlic Festival in Gilroy, California, but he promises to be back in the new year. Our legal counsel this week and every week is provided by the law offices of Gallipo and Taylor, where their motto is, "We're committed to mediocrity." Catering this week provided by Hagee's House of Tacos, home of Big Al's pan-seared, paw-revered, broccoli-speared, mountaineered, cashiered, dog-eared, western hemisphered, world-premiered, worse-than-you-feared, bio-engineered, drippy enchilada. If you have an iPhone, you can find our podcast at the App Store or on the podcast app on your phone. If you have an Android, look for us at Google Play. Tell your friends and family, because no sense suffering through this nonsense alone. You can find out everything about the Georgia Historical Society at georgiahistory.com and the Georgia History Festival at georgiahistoryfestival.org. Please also check out my blog and similarly holly jolly podcast at deatonpath.georgiahistory.com. If you have any comments about this show or about life in general, please drop me a line at sdeaton@georgiahistory.com. As always, thank you for listening. We hope that you and yours have a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. So long, everybody.